So this is September 11th, 2016, 15 years after the tragedies of 2001. I actually started this group not long after, very shortly after September 11th. There's actually at least one person in the room who was at our first class. Maybe more than one. I've often talked about how I was able to use my skills and my practice during that time, and how it supported me, my skills and my practice. And it really wasn't much about meditating, because that was not really a time when, probably went 2 or 3 weeks when I didn't meditate. Meditation isn't always what we do. There's many other skills that we learn. Sometimes meditation isn't what's called for. It was obviously a time of great inner turmoil, outer turmoil, many tears, grief, sorrow, fear, a lot of very difficult feelings, a lot of suffering, quite strong amount of suffering, darkness, if you will. And one of the things that for me was so important at that time of darkness, of suffering, was to be able to keep my mind bright, was to be able to find brightness in my mind, find brightness in my heart. And we always need to do this, but particularly when we're trying to hold so much suffering and so much difficulty and challenge, it has to be balanced with brightness. It has to be balanced with joy. One of the things that I would just do would be to, I live right near the river, the East River, so I would just go for a walk along the river. And nature, of course, is one great way to bring brightness to the mind, bring joy to the mind, or I'd go for a walk in the park. So we always need to remember the goodness in the world. We always need to remember the goodness in the world. We always need to remember the goodness within us and the goodness that we've been exposed to, that we've seen through the kindness that's been demonstrated towards us. We need to acknowledge suffering. We need to acknowledge suffering. That's obviously a very important part of our practice. But we also need to acknowledge, and we need to acknowledge, you know, the suffering within us and the suffering in the world. But we also need to acknowledge our goodness and the goodness in the world. And as I like to say, there's room for both. There's room for both. And that's one of the things that we learn in this practice, that our human experience is made up, as I often say, of many experiences. We learn that not intellectually because some teacher tells us, but because we see that. You know, because that's what meditation allows us to do, is to see what's true. So it allows us to see, you know, and again, I might not have been meditating at that time, but I've been meditating for a long time, more than a decade. So, you know, to be able to see clearly, to have enough space to be able to see, well, there's suffering and sadness and darkness, but there's also room for joy. There's room for both. If I was going to be glib about that, I would say that's a mark of spiritual maturity. I won't say that. And I talked about this last week, right? One of the things I talked about was how our tendency is to look toward what's difficult, to look at what's painful. The term the Buddha used is the inclination of our awareness. So in the meditation, the mind may have inclined towards what was painful in the body, right? It goes right to what was painful. That's why we spend so much time cultivating ease and well-being in the body and then training the mind to incline to that. And that, so much time is really, because it has to be a training. It has to be a training because our tendency, our pattern, our inclination, the inclination of our awareness is to go to what's painful. So you probably saw that in this meditation, or the inclination of our awareness in terms of our thinking is to go to thoughts that are informed by aversion, thoughts that are painful, thoughts about things that and thoughts that are informed by unskillful mental qualities about things that we find difficult or challenge, the things that are wrong in our lives, the people that we don't like, so on and so forth, right? And then of course, you know, we look at the world and our tendency, as I talked about last week, is to look at the world and see all the things that are negative. That's the inclination of our awareness, you know. I mean, I was kind of saying last week, it's like, you know, and just look at like television, you know, and you turn on television and you know, that's what you see. But, you know, the thing of it is like, you know, the people who run television shows are really smart. They know the inclination of our awareness is to things that are difficult and painful and unsavory. So they put those shows on, you know? It's on us. It's on us. You know, the more that we incline, I see that in my own mind now. We don't talk about politics, but you know, even just like the difference between this year politically and an election year and other years, it's like my mind isn't inclining to things that are unpleasant and unsavory as much as it was in the past, because I've trained my mind not to necessarily incline in those ways. And of course, we have to look at those things again. But, you know, things have to be in balance. Things have to be in balance. I talked last week about how Ajahn Phuong, who was my teacher's teacher, used to say about Ajahn Lee, and Ajahn Lee, of course, was Ajahn Phuong's teacher, and really the Thai master that, you know, the style of breath meditation that we teach comes from. And how Ajahn Phuong liked to say that Ajahn Lee taught me, he said, Ajahn Lee taught me to see the brightness in the world. He taught me to see the brightness in the world. So, and you know, and then that's kind of the way that Ajahn Phuong characterized the gift that Ajahn Lee left behind, you know, because, I mean, that's, it's an extraordinary gift, the gift of showing somebody to see the brightness of the world. And the understanding that, you know, and having that and being able to develop that understanding that there is this extraordinary brightness in the world. Extraordinary brightness in the world. Extraordinary goodness in the world and within us and within all of us. So this is something, you know, we need to see. I mean, ultimately it comes down to, you know, seeing the brightness within us and the goodness within us. Because the way we look at the world is, you know, as I said, is the way we look at ourselves. We look at all of our negative things, our life, you know, and all the negativity that we have about that. So one of the sort of default practices that the Buddha taught was to go to nature. If there's a lot of suffering and you're caught in darkness, go to nature to bring brightness to the mind. because the goodness in nature, the goodness in the world is expressed in nature, and it brings brightness to the mind. So that's, you know, something that is really important for us to do, I think. You know, it can be really hard living here, but we can do it. And then, really, the next thing that the Buddha taught, or one of the next important things that he taught in terms of bringing brightness to the world, to, in terms of seeing the brightness of the world, to having that understanding of the goodness in the world, is to associate with wise beings. That's why we have this group, you know, so that you have a place to go where you can associate with wise beings. And, you know, this association with wise beings brings brightness to the mind. I mean, I think most of the time, I know for me, and I'm the teacher, it's a little different, but you know, most of the time, I leave this class in a different space than when I entered it, you know, and most people say that, you know. I mean, that's sort of what the empirical data shows, you know. So, you know, you learn to get smart feet, right? You know, it's like if you're in darkness, get to the class. Maybe that's the most important thing about this class. Just like Ajahn Lee showed Ajahn Phuong the brightness in the world, maybe this class can help us, this group can help us know the brightness in the world. And when we associate with wise beings, we're associating with beings who are making the effort to see the brightness in the world, to know it, to find the brightness in the world. And we are seeing for ourselves firsthand that there is a brightness in the world by having this association with these beings, because they show us that through their kindness. We talked about this last week. The kindness of the people, you know, in many ways, you know, this group is founded on kindness. I mean, that's why we have, you know, the rules that we follow, you know, the precepts in particular. But you know, when we try to follow the rules of mindful speech and learn to relate to each other with love and compassion, so you know we can look at the world and you know we can incline our mind to seeing all the things that are dark. But you know we can, and obviously it doesn't have to be just this group, but we can choose to see and understand the brightness in the world and in turn understand that brightness within us. And those are two kind of really simple ways to do it. I mean, is there anybody here who can't do those two things? I mean, obviously, the second one, I know you can do it because you're here. So the first one, go to nature, I'm assuming everybody here can do that, you know? So we talked last week about cultivating appreciation for the things that are good as a way of brightening the mind. We talk a lot about this, of course. You know, we talk about it not just as a practice that we should do at the beginning of our meditation, but also throughout the course of our days. We cultivate appreciation by cultivating gratitude. And I won't go into this too much, but I talked last week in large part about what the Buddha said about gratitude and that, you know, the foundation of developing gratitude is developing gratitude for those beings in your life that have shown you kindness, you know, and that really begins with our parents who've given us the gift of life, you know, in many ways have. I mean, for everybody, your parents gave you the gift of life. So you know, right there, that's cause for immense gratitude, the greatest gratitude there is. You know, they've given us the most important gift that there is, that kindness that they've shown us by giving us that gift. There's no greater kindness. Sort of if we don't acknowledge that, you know, it's sort of like denigrating the gift that we've been given. So it kind of puts us in a difficult position in terms of what we're asked to do in this practice. It's like if somebody gives you the greatest gift that they could possibly give you, and your attitude towards that person is only negative, you know, that gift really loses a lot of, if not all of, its meaning. So, you know, again, we talked about room, there being room for both. You know, you can still hate your parents and think that they were fucked up, you know, but you can also acknowledge the great kindness that they've shown you, showed you in giving you life, and giving you the gift of this precious life. And then, of course, so many other beings who've shown us kindness, So many. As I talked about last week, our tendency again is to incline towards this person did that, and this person did this, and this person, you know, or this person did this that I didn't like, but not acknowledging the thing that they did that was an expression of kindness. This is, again, this is sort of a mark of spiritual maturity, being able to see things clearly. Yeah, there's a lot of anger, hatred, difficult things in the world, but there's also an immense amount of kindness and love and joy. And in many ways, we have the choice to choose how we want to live. There's great potential for happiness in this life. You know, it's kind of, I mean, life is kind of a funny thing. You know, we live it. We have this life, we have our life, but you know, what the Buddha was interested in was understanding life. You know, it's kind of like, I mean, we're funny people. I mean, you know, we can drive a car, we don't need to understand how it works. I mean, you sort of need to understand, car metaphors are never good in New York City, but you know, you need to understand how to start it. Nowadays, they make it even easier. I think all you have to do is push a button or something, you know, but you know, so many things, like, you know, you use a blender, you don't really need to understand how it works, you know. But, you know, life, it helps if you understand what it's all about. You know? That was what the Buddha was interested in. What is this life? And what he found, of course, that, you know, he was able to find the brightness of the world, just like Ajahn Phuong, learning under Ajahn Lee, was able to see the brightness of the world. This life, there's potential for great happiness, for great goodness, for joy, for beauty. The problem isn't life. You know, we blame life, but the problem really is what we're doing with the opportunity that we have to make the most out of life, and the opportunity that we have to know the goodness in life, the joy in life, the beauty in life. You know, we tend to look for happiness. Where do we tend to look for, you know, in this life? I mean, this is what the Buddha kind of started asking. Like, where am I looking for happiness? This is this human life, and, you know, I'm looking for happiness and sense pleasure and in status and gain and possessions and all these different kinds of things. You take a real step back from that, you know, like he did, and you say, you know, this is really isn't much, you know? I mean, it's not much of a life, you know? And what really does it really mean anything, all these things? Is this all it is? Some sense pleasure, some possession, some status, some praise. Is that, or is there something better than it? I mean, those things are good to some extent. When you really look at them, they're really pretty much, it's very limited. It's a very limited way to live. I mean, looking for happiness in life, again, at the risk of being glib, you know, in the new iPhone, is a very limited way of life. looking for happiness in the image on the phone. It's a very limited way of living. But that's really what many of us are doing, right? We're all doing it to some extent. We're looking for happiness in money and the things that money can buy. So much of our effort goes into that, you know, and of course we have to make some effort, you know, and this is part of the inherent suffering in life, that we have to make some effort to make money so that we can support ourselves, you know. For most of us, there's not any way around that. That's not the question. The question is, like, how much do we really need? How much do we really need? I mean, that's a central question, you know, in our practice, right? Sometimes I think about talking about this, I can't talk about this, people. That's what this practice is so much about. It's like, how much stuff do you need? How much money do you really need? You know, I can even feel it myself, a little leery about talking about it. So we, you know, we have these ways of looking for happiness, and they become patterns, you know. They become patterns of conformity. You know, we just kind of do the same thing day after day after day after day. And of course, the ways that we're looking for happiness are supported by the culture and the people in our lives. Just as the way the Buddha was looking for happiness before he became the Buddha, that way of looking for happiness was supported by his father and the people in his lives. The culture supports the patterns of conformity that we live in. I mean, this is something that I really kind of like look at my life, you know, and I really try to look at it really clearly. And it's like, how much difference is there from day to day? I mean, you know, that's something really good to look at. It's like sometimes we meditate so we don't have to look at those things, you know? But really the meditation is so that you can start looking at your life and say, like, how much difference is there really from day to day? Am I just doing the same thing day after day after day after day? Think about like when you were a child. It's like every day was different. Every day was new. It was incredible novelty. And Thoreau talked about this a lot. Said, I left the woods for as good a reason as I went there. Perhaps it seemed to me that I had several more lives to live and could not spare any more time for that one. It is remarkable how easily and insensibly we fall into a particular route and make a beaten track for ourselves. I had not lived there a week before my feet wore a path from my door to the pond side, and though it is 5 or 6 years since I trod it, it is still quite distinct. It is true, I fear, that others may have fallen into it and so helped to keep it open. The surface of the earth is soft and impressible by the feet of men, and so with the paths which the mind travels. How worn and dusty, then, must be the highways of the world. How deep the ruts of tradition and conformity. Thoreau said there's so much novelty in the world. And yet we, and so much brightness, and yet we tolerate this incredible dullness. So, you know, we don't make the most of this life. I mean, that's why we're here, to make the most of this life. And, you know, really what that means is, you know, because we have this potential for great brightness and for our lives to be extraordinarily bright and novel and joyful, you know, and that potential lies in the heart. You know, that's why we practice. So, you know, our problem is we don't make the most of the heart. We don't make the most of the heart. And so much of our effort in practice, I talked a lot about this on this summer's retreat, is, you know, making this journey into the heart. And the journey into the heart is through the body. So much of, you know, the Buddha said, if you can get into the body, you can get into the heart. So our goodness is manifested through what we understand in the heart and what we understand about what we need to do and the strength in the heart, the surety and confidence in the heart to do that. But that all is, comes from the heart. So we can kind of follow the ways of the world, or we can learn to follow our hearts and express our goodness. And this is where it always gets a little tricky, I think, because, you know, to some extent, I think we're sort of, for many of us, not everybody, but I think we all are to some extent, unclear about how to express our goodness. And truly, you know, only the heart knows, but, you know, there has to be some signposts along the way. You know, it's like the heart knows the pain and holding on to anger or resentment. The heart knows the truth that, you know, if we live these lives of conformity and if we look for happiness in these very meaningless things, we're not making the most of our lives. And the heart also knows, you know, what we need to do. But having some signposts, if you will, I think is useful. Sort of a long introduction to the next part of the talk. How do we express our goodness? You know, Nietzsche had an interesting way of looking at this. You know, he talked about three types of beings that, from what he could see and understand about life, were making this effort to express their goodness and were making the most out of their lives. The first category was the monk. And, you know, by that we can think of just like, you know, somebody who's looking to live a spiritual life, somebody who's looking and making an effort to, you know, follow the path of the heart. The second category was the artist. The artist. Person who, through their art, expresses their goodness. You know, I mean, this really comes to what the Buddha said about, you know, if you really want to express your goodness, you know, you have to look at yourself and what makes you come alive and what, you know, it's, you know, we tend to think about this as like, how can I help somebody else? But it's really like, how can I shine? How can my goodness shine? And the artist, if it's whatever area of art, I mean, I think that's, you know, when I think about this, I think that's why I write, because, you know, it's like, and it's sort of like, why do you have to do it every day? Because when I'm doing that, I'm not following those ruts of conformity. You know, I'm opening up to, you know, this pure expression of the heart in many ways, or this expression of the heart, or an effort to make an expression of the heart. Everything is new and fresh and different and bright. The third category, of course, this is Nietzsche, is the philosopher, you know? But when I think of what he's talking about the philosopher, it's, you know, it's like somebody who's interested in life and what life is and how can I make the most of life? What's the meaning of life? So, you know, I think these are, you know, three paradigms that every one of us can apply. Every one of us can apply these paradigms, all three really, the monk, the artist, and the philosopher. How much of our lives, you know, sort of embodies those paradigms? How can we do that? Well, that's, again, what meditation offers us. It offers us the skills of being able to be centered you know, and to have some space from our experience and to be able to observe our experience and to be able to observe life instead of being caught up in it. Meditation gives us that kind of vision to see things clearly. Concentration gives us that ability to see things clearly and to look and to be heedful and to understand what's an expression of goodness, to understand where brightness is, to understand what brightness is. Meditation, as I've said, enables us to be connected to the heart. Because you know, we can try and try, but you know, and that's why we say, I really want to do this, I really want to do this, I really want to do, you know, I hear Dubinin's talk and I'm going to go out there tomorrow and I'm going to be a monk and an artist and a philosopher, you know. It's like, and this, why is it so hard? You know, because we get caught up, because we're not connected to the heart. You know, it's only when we're connected to the heart and we truly understand what we need to do in order to fulfill our wish to be happy that we really do it. Once you really know what you need to do and what an expression of your wish to be happy is, you don't really have any choice but to do it. I mean, it's sort of why people say, you know, it's like, I don't really have any choice but to meditate, because we sort of know that that's the monk, right? We know that that's the path to happiness. It's like when you know in the heart, you know, that's what, and the more you know in the heart, the more you'll meditate. The more you know in the heart what it is that you need to do to be happy, then you move in that direction. It's like we want to try to create a life for ourselves, but the practice is really about creating a connection to the heart and letting the heart show you the way. Taking that path of action and being true to the heart. And being true to the heart. I mean, this is a path of being true to the heart. If we're true to the heart, we'll make the most of this human life. If we're true to the heart, we'll know the happiness that this life can offer. We'll know the brightness of the world. So let's just close our eyes for a minute.